IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm your host, Shri Krishna Upadhyaya. And my guest today on the show is Manoj Kevalramani, the chairperson of Indo-Pacific Program at Takshashila and a resident China expert. Welcome to All Things Policy, Manoj.
Thanks, Shri. How are you?
I'm good. So, Manoj, today we'll be discussing about the latest actions of your favorite Chinese president, Xi Jinping, from last week, where after winning an unprecedented third term, he made his first diplomatic visit abroad. And he decided to visit Russia. And this comes close on the heels of the International Criminal Court issuing a warrant against Vladimir Putin, who is probably very isolated in the global order today. So what do you think of this visit? What do you think is the significance of this visit by Xi Jinping? And do you think it was surprising at all that he chose Russia as the first destination after his re-election?
Hey, so I don't think it was surprising at all. I mean, I think that when you look at the world from Beijing's perspective, what you see is an extremely hostile world where there are tremendous challenges, particularly in terms of American policy towards China. Beijing believes that there is an effort at essentially containment that is underway, led by the United States and the West. You know, European countries partnering with America. And others, of course, they see sort of the Quad, AUKUS, all of these are signs of containment. And when you look around the neighborhood from Beijing's perspective, its southern and eastern seas are turbulent. Its boundary with India is unstable. There are challenges in Central Asia. So it finds itself in a difficult and challenging world today, where it also sees some opportunities because China's power has grown and it is able to engineer certain outcomes. Now, given this environment, when it looks around at the world, it sees the relationship with Russia as a stable relationship where there is some degree of, actually significant degree of strategic congruence, where both of them feel that there is a common threat that they face from the United States-led West, and they want to push back against that. At the same time, they feel that there is, like Xi Jinping told Putin in a video that went viral, there are unprecedented changes that are taking place in the balance of power in the world, and they have an opportunity to push back and to craft a new international order. So in that sense, this broad strategic congruence between the two countries makes it clear that, you know, that this would be perhaps his first visit because he's starting a new term. He's starting, you know, a new sort of agenda that he's got in his, on his plate. And this would be his first visit. The other important thing to keep in mind is that over the last decade, Xi Jinping and Putin have had a fairly close personal relationship. You know, they've met, I think Putin's the leader that he's met the most in the world at any point of time. They've had 40 meetings over the last 10 years, which is 4 meetings a year on an average, which is quite significant. They've had significant bilateral exchanges. So it's not surprising that he would choose that. And I think the Chinese are not even shy about making that very, very clear. So when the Chinese foreign minister was asked about the choice of Russia as the first visit, he was quite clear. He was like, look, this was a political decision made after careful consideration. The relationship has its own sort of strategic logic, but it also has a historic logic because Russia and China are each other's largest neighbors. And, you know, they have this long boundary, this long history, and they see themselves as not allies in the traditional sense of allies, but as partners in crafting a new world order. So in that sense, not surprising at all that this was his first choice.
Right. And in terms of this visit itself, there was some noise made by China that, you know, they are looking for peace in Ukraine. That in fact, they have not hit their ambitions to emerge as a deal maker, a peacemaker in the Ukraine conflict involving Russia as well. But what were the significant outcomes from this visit? And so do we have anything concrete looking forward?
Right. So I think there were lots of things that came out, right? The first thing, obviously, is like you in your opening question, when you talked about, you know, Putin being isolated and Xi Jinping going there. The first thing was obviously the optics of it, right? The fact that where, say, Europe has been sort of trying to press Beijing to leverage its influence with Moscow to try and pull back and at least enter into some sort of a ceasefire and some sort of peace talks, which begins with obviously Russia withdrawing from Ukraine. You know, Beijing is basically saying that, look, yes, we don't necessarily want the war to escalate, but, you know, and we'll do what we can, but it's not something that we necessarily hold that much sway over. At the same time, there are certain concrete outcomes, right? I mean, the two sides sort of had this very long joint statement. There were two joint statements that were released. One was a statement about, a 2030, pre-2030 development plan, which talked about sort of priorities of where their development areas are going to be. There were eight areas that were highlighted, which was trade, logistics, financial cooperation, energy, supply of resources like metals, fertilizers, chemical products, mineral resources, technology cooperation, industry cooperation, agriculture. So these were sort of eight broad areas where they said that they would look to deepen cooperation, which is essentially a very, very broad agenda that the both sides have. On trade specifically, you know, bilateral trade has increased significantly over the last year since the war in Ukraine, with China becoming Russia's biggest energy partner, importing a massive amount of energy resources from Russia. There has been talk about a second pipeline, the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline, which did not materialize even in this meeting. But that's something that has been talked about for some time now. You know, I think last Russian supplies to sort of gas supplies to China are expected to reach at least, say, 98 billion cubic meters by 2030. And, you know, so there's tremendous growth in that. Bilateral trade is expected to hit $200 billion this year. It's currently at about $185 billion, if I'm correct. And a lot of this is being driven by energy cooperation. Russia has invested in China's nuclear energy projects, so it's engaged over there. There's agricultural trade between the two countries, which is growing. And that's critical from a Chinese point of view, because China believes that food security is a significant challenge that it's going to continue to deal with, given its limited arable land and large population. And given the fact that rainfall patterns and disasters, flooding and the droughts are sort of happening simultaneously in different parts of the country. So there is a challenge in that regard. Another tangible outcome is the use of the RMB for bilateral trade settlement. Putin, in his public statements, talked about how he supports the use of yuan in further transactions, not just for Russia-China bilateral trade, but also for Russia's trade with partners in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. This is critical, and this means potentially could mean greater internationalization of the yuan, which has been an agenda for Beijing for quite some time. And this is an outcome of Western sanctions, right? From data that, you know, people have put together, there's a piece by Alexander Gabuyev, which we can share in show notes, where he talks about how the share of Russian exports settled in the RMB grew from 0.4% to 14% in the first 9 months of 2022. So you can see that tremendous change that has happened. You know, Russia is holding much more yuan right now as part of its foreign currency reserves. So that's a critical outcome, which I think is developing, you know, and this visit will further underscore this. There are these excellent videos of Russian businessmen and propagandists sort of talking about, you know, there's a reporter asking one of them about, you know, what is it, you know, the CEO of Rosneft, Igor Sechin, he's been asked about, you know, well, the last time we spoke to you, you said that you knew one Chinese word, which was the yuan. What new words have you learned right now? And he says, many yuans. So it just tells you a little bit about the changing dynamic of the relationship. So that's one part of it, that the economic engagement is deepening and will continue to deepen. There have been some reports about possibly Chinese-made weapons appearing in Ukraine, but there's still lots of sketchiness about whether Beijing is supplying any sort of weaponry. On to the joint statement, which was a critical outcome of this entire meeting. This was a really, really long, detailed document, which talked about many, many issues. I did a full breakdown of this in my newsletter. And, you know, it talks about fundamentally what brings the two countries together. And it says, very interesting phrasing over there. It says that, look, this is a relationship which is not similar to the military or political alliance during the Cold War, but it rather transcends this model of state-to-state relations. It is a relationship that has the nature of being non-aligned, being non-confrontational, and does not target third countries. So take those words for what it is, but the fact is that this is an extremely close relationship, which is not an alliance, which means that the dependencies and the requirements and the commitments are limited, which gives some more freedom to each party to act in their own interests. But that does not mean that they are not deeply connected. So that restatement of that is extremely important, because it tells you a little bit about the fact that this is a really, really close relationship, And while we're not seeing Beijing supporting Russia directly in terms of its military effort, every other kind of support is being lent, and that will continue to be lent. So that's a critical part of this. The other critical part of this joint statement is that it talked about the impact on the Indo-Pacific region, right? And it specifically criticizes the US's Indo-Pacific strategy, NATO, and NATO's expansion. Essentially, it sees parallels like their February 4th, 2022 statement did between what's happening in Europe and what's happening in the Indo-Pacific region, which is important from an Indian point of view. Right, because it means that Russia and China have a common view on what's happening in these two countries with regard to the United States, which means that it's going to be challenging for India, and it's going to be difficult for India to keep maintaining proximity with Russia while deepening its relationship with the United States. And it also means that China's engagement with Russia is going to complicate, you know, India's security situation, because what would Russia do when, say, if and when India and China were to enter into a conflict, possibly. So all those sort of things, I think, are useful to keep in mind. The last point that I will sort of end with, because this is long and I could go on and on forever, but the last point that I will end with is that there is a clear strategic congruence between the two sides. And I think Putin, in his press statement with Xi Jinping, specifically said something to the effect of how we have similar views on the world order. I think this is really important to understand, because this is essentially what's driving the relationship forward. It's as much as pushing back against the US, as much as it is about creating a new order, not just from an economic point of view, from a security point of view, but also from the point of view of what are the values of this order. And they both talk about, you know, democracy, nobody having a patent on democracy, and everybody being their own kind of democracy, and that sort of stuff. To me, that undermines certain basic values that you see are universal. And I think that is, that can be terribly problematic, even from an Indian interest perspective. So it's important for us to keep in mind this. And I think that those are some of the big outcomes. On Ukraine, I don't think we saw anything significant than what we would have expected. I can probably end with that, because in Ukraine, a lot of people were anticipating that, oh, the Chinese have proposed a peace plan and all that. But there was no sort of peace plan that was put out by either side at the end of this meeting.
Right.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
So from the way I understood, so essentially the strategic congruence has three sides to it. One is, of course, deepening economic cooperation between both these nations. The second pillar being denouncing American expansionism, so to speak. And thirdly, reshaping the world order based on values which are different and maybe even antithetical to the liberal world order. So apart from this, I wanted to press you a little bit more on the Ukraine question, because that is interesting, right? So right now, let's face it, the reality is that China is the senior partner in the relationship with the Russians. And this lopsided relationship means that China exerts significant amount of strategic influence over Putin's actions. And this is partly because of the economic sanctions which the West has imposed, which has made Russia all the more dependent on China today. So if China enjoys so much power over the Russians, so to speak, do you see China pushing Russia over Ukraine at all? Where do Chinese interests lie here? Are they okay to let the war progress, prolong, or do they also want it to stop as soon as possible? And maybe they will even try to get Russia to sort of hold back.
So I don't necessarily agree with the idea that, you know, while we see in the media there are lots of commentaries about, you know, Russia being a junior partner and potentially a vassal state also, I don't necessarily see it that way. I think that that is an extremely exaggerated claim. Russia is a significant power in its own right. Obviously, its power and its projection of that power and its appeal stand significantly diminished given its performance in the war in Ukraine. But I think it still remains a significant power on the global stage, because it has tremendous capacity to disrupt, at least to, if nothing else, right? And its economy, of course, has struggled, and it's continuing to struggle given the sanctions. Yet it has tremendous natural resources. It's failed to diversify the economy, but the natural resources have kept it going. So I don't think that it is an insignificant power in a vassal state. I don't think even some comparisons to it being like North Korea and all that, I don't think that is the case. I think Russia still remains a significant power. That said, I think that the other piece of this puzzle is, how do the Chinese think about Russia? And what you will see in Chinese writings and commentaries is that while there is tremendous support, there is also a lot of criticism of Russia. as Russian policy being disruptive and being therefore problematic. And this is in comparison to Chinese power, because China has accumulated many different sources of power owing to its economic growth, its diversification of its economy, owing to its investments in military, manpower development, technology, and all of those things. And its ability to therefore use different tools to coerce adversaries. And, you know, the strategic culture of China and Russia is different. The other sort of part of this is also that when you look at Chinese domestic discourse, you will see often that there is at least some degree of self-reflection about a sense of inferiority with regard to Russia. And this has roots sort of deep in history. Also, and if you just go back to about 100 years ago, you know, the Communist Party of China was subordinate to the Soviet Union, you know, the CPSU. So I think that is this deep-seated sense of inferiority which exists. And this Chinese scholars and analysts have spoken about it. Right? It's not like they don't talk about this. So I don't think it's necessary that the view is of a, you know, big partner and junior partner at present. Now, that said, you asked about Ukraine. I think that what China's interest in Ukraine, I don't think it's the war is necessarily something. Could Beijing have done without the war? Perhaps yes. But once the war started, does it necessarily mean a negative consequence for China? Perhaps not, right? I mean, at some level, you've got the West engaged in Europe and therefore distracted from the Indo-Pacific to some degree. Although America has shown that it can engage on both fronts. But you've also got a Europe and European powers which are deeply concerned about the events that are taking place in Europe. And while they have become much more aware about what's happening in the Indo-Pacific, their primary interests are now in Europe. So the West's attention is divided, which is beneficial for Beijing. At the same time, the war has sort of created some sort of a North-South divide, right? Where the global South is not necessarily interested in getting engaged. They are also critical of the West and they are critical of NATO, at least some countries. But they are basically not wanting to get engaged and they want the focus to be on what are the downstream consequences of the war in terms of commodity prices, development, capital flows, all of that. And the challenges that present. So that divide is also beneficial from Beijing's point of view. And it's used these opportunities to try and make a narrative push by saying, look, the West is essentially in NATO and this group confrontation thinking is essentially what is driving these problems. And if you don't want these problems to be part of the Asia-Pacific, the Indo-Pacific, then reject it. So it's not necessarily that it's all been negative. These are sort of big strategic positives of the war continuing. The concern is that, of course, the war has had an economic downstream impact on China also. It has limited, it creates restrictions on what Chinese companies can do in trade. It limits the nature of China-Russia cooperation to some degree. It also presents a challenge where Europe is asking tough questions of China, you know, and it's becoming tougher on China. There's a certain transatlantic unity that has been built up. So it has these negative effects on Beijing also. So I think in some, I don't think Beijing minds the war continuing at present, but it doesn't want to be seen as a party to it. It wants to be seen like its hands are off. It doesn't want to see escalation. And if it wants to see any sort of conversation around the settlement of the war and the ending of the conflict, it wants to see it not in terms of Russia losing the conflict or Russia sort of evacuating and stepping back completely, but rather it wants to see a dialogue on a new European security architecture, which undermines and pushes back on NATO. So if these are to be kept in mind, I think that Beijing is okay with the war continuing till it doesn't escalate. So therefore, when you see Xi Jinping visiting Moscow and if you see the joint statement, it refers to, you know, that a nuclear war must not be fought. It talks about the need for talks. But if you read the actual language that is used when it comes to this need for talks, it is really, really interesting because it says that, you know, Beijing says that the two sides point out that to settle the Ukraine crisis, the legitimate security concerns of all countries must be respected. This basically means Russian interests must be respected. Bloc confrontation should be prevented, which basically means that NATO should step back, if not disband, and fanning the flames should be avoided, which basically means that countries should stop sending weapons and support to Ukraine. So it's basically saying that if I want the war to end and I want Ukraine to surrender, and then let's talk about what's the future of NATO. So none of this tells me that they want the war to end immediately. But yes, they don't want it to escalate into a nuclear conflict or a strategic conflict between two superpowers.
Thanks, Manoj. So I want to bring you back to home, to India, to sort of understand what the implications are of this closer China and Russia relationship that we see today. I think you mentioned at the beginning also that the strategic congruence has implications in the Indo-Pacific, where India and China are at odds and don't necessarily see eye to eye. And in case Russia sides with the Chinese position on Indo-Pacific, this can have serious implications on India-Russia relationship, which, you know, India has done a good job of balancing so far. So where do you think India-Russia relations are headed? And do you think the Russians will also have to account for India in their calculations with Russia?
Look, good question. And I agree that, look, already Russia is sort of having to account for India, because soon after this meeting between Xi Jinping and Putin, the Russian ambassador to India, Denis Alipov, talked about the visit. And he said that, you know, it is, quote, wishful thinking, unquote, that India's relationship with Russia would be damaged because of proximity between China and Russia. He put this out on Twitter saying, you know, and I again quote him, profusion of analysis these days of the outcomes of Xi Jinping's Russia's visit. The impression as though various reputable Indian experts almost dream of Russia-China ties harming Russia-India strategic alignment. A wishful thinking, case in point, unquote. So, but the fact that he's having to make this intervention tells you that there is increasing unease in Delhi about the proximity between Beijing and Moscow. Now, a lot of critics will say that, look, the India-Russia relationship is extremely deep. It is historic. There are deep, you know, there is no conflict of interest between the two sides. And there has been a historic friendship, which, you know, means that this relationship will survive. And both sides need each other. India needs Russia, not just from a defense and energy perspective, but also from the point of view of its continental security, whether it is Central Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran. And India needs, and Russia needs India for many things, from, you know, defense exports to even offering an opportunity to engage with other parts of the world in the global south, but also to sort of, you know, balance China in terms of the Eurasian landmass to some degree. So yes, you can see all sides of this argument, and all of this makes sense. But at the same time, the fact is that it's not about whether Russia would be willing to support India or not. It's also a question of whether Russia will be capable. The longer this war progresses, the more drain it is on Russian defense industry, the more it is focused towards its domestic needs and its war fighting efforts. How much of this will impact sustainability of provision of Russian's arms supplies to India? A lot of, say, for example, the entire Indian tank fleet is sort of, you know, Russian made, and it requires maintenance reserves. India requires ammunition, which comes from Russia. What is the sustainability of that supply as things go on? And particularly in case of conflict with China, what will be the sustainability of that supply? I think these are the kind of questions that we need to talk about. So even if one is not going to question the intent, you know, it's important to think of what practical implications may be. On the intent front, if a Russia that is heavily economically dependent on China on just about everything finds itself in the midst of a conflict between India and China, where Beijing was to request that you delay some things, that you deny some things, what is the possibility or the probability of Russia acceding to that request and temporarily denying or delaying some things? The probability sort of increases, right, as the proximity of that relationship increases. So that's again something for Indian policymakers to keep in mind, and even for people debating online and in the media to keep in mind that, you know, it's no use to think of this from a historical lens and say, well, 50 years ago, this is what happened. Let's look at the realities of today. Let's look at what is happening and what's going to happen in the future potentially because of these changing dynamics. And let's try and think of how that can impact our security. The final thing that I will say is, on more than one occasion, the Russians have had absolutely no issue with being in Delhi and criticizing Indian policy with regard to the Quad or the Indo-Pacific. It's done while criticizing American policies with regard to the Indo-Pacific. Again, in this joint statement with Xi Jinping, the document talks about the US's Indo-Pacific strategy, essentially trying to create a sort of camp system in this part of the world. So I think that it's important for us to keep in mind that this congruence exists, and this will have implications for us. And I think that is something that we should keep in mind. So while it's important that we maintain a steady relationship with Russia, the utility of that relationship might just increasingly be declining from an Indian point of view. And it is important for us to, while maintaining that relationship, build some more resilience, particularly when it comes to our defense equipment and procurement, so that we are able to actually arrive at a balance if push comes to shove and if these such situations sort of arise. I mean, increasingly you can see, right, that there are places where the Russians can't do much. For example, when the at the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization a couple of years ago, when they set up a specific group to discuss Afghanistan, India was excluded from that group, and while Russia was part of that group. So we were not part of some of these groups despite being a member of the SCO. So I think it's important for us to keep in mind also realistically what is happening in the Russia and China relationship and how that will impact us, because it will sooner or later have an impact on India's strategic environment. Again, I must reiterate, I am by no means saying that India must be dumping Russia as a partner. There is a value. There is a value in also providing Russia with alternative partners so that it does not find itself isolated enough that it must further depend on Beijing. But the challenge is this, right? If India can provide Russia, whatever India can provide Russia with, China can provide Russia the same in much more quantities, you know. So it's always going to be difficult to compete with that. But do you want to keep that alignment, possibility of that alignment open? Yes. But it's increasingly going to be difficult to maintain that balance. Again, no easy answers, but I think it's worth us keeping that in mind and not going back to emotional historic arguments. Let's think about the here and now.
Right. And like you mentioned, it's not so much about the intent, but as to the actual outcomes based in reality. And maybe it is a time that India does overall reassessment as to where its actual economic and security interests lie. Anyway, thanks a lot, Manoj, for joining me on this conversation, and we look forward to more.
Thanks so much. I want to end by reminding everyone a little bit about China-Russia relationship. And again, I want to end with a quote from the Chinese foreign minister when he talked about the nature of the relationship. Because there's been so much talk about this being either an alliance or a marriage of convenience. How the Chinese foreign minister phrased it was that this is a friendship between gentlemen. So there are two things that you can take away from that, that, you know, there are obviously problems, and that's why Xi Jinping and Putin's relationship, personal relationship, is important. So we don't know how, you know, yes, I don't think the relationship will collapse if those two were to vanish, but it will change. But also secondly, usually such handshakes between gentlemen can lead to some very difficult trade-offs for third countries. So India should keep that in mind.
Right. And also, I think former Ambassador Mohan Kumar has described this in an article as Russian ballet with Chinese characteristics. So what
Indeed.
Do you think of that?
Yeah, indeed. I think that there is. I think that's a good way to put it, because at the end of the day, both are represented, and I don't think it's as one-sided as people, at least in the press, in the Western press, have made it out to be.
Yeah. Thanks, Manoj.
Thanks.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.